From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Both hours of today's show are going to be devoted to covering violence and murder in this country. Next hour, we're going to air an interview that we did with Jeremy Richmond in 2017. Jeremy was the father of Aviel Richmond, who was 6 years old when she was killed in the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. That conversation with Jeremy Richmond is visceral, and frankly, we want you to hear it in light of the murder of children yesterday in Texas. This hour, we had asked Patrick Blanchfield to come back on the program following the Buffalo mass shooting earlier this month. We, of course, could not have known that Patrick's appearance would follow yet another mass murder at an American school. As of this hour, we know that 19 children are dead. Two teachers are dead in Texas. School officials have warned those numbers could rise still. According to journalists in Texas, the shooter bought two AR platform rifles on his 18th birthday. Last night, President Biden asked when Americans are going to demand action. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas said that Republicans would not support new gun laws because they don't work and they only penalize law-abiding gun owners. Meanwhile, heads of state across the world have offered their condolences, but also at times their bewilderment. This is essentially an American problem in a country with by far the highest per capita number of guns in circulation of Western nations. Kids are taught where to hide if a shooter comes to their classroom, even though, as one third grader said yesterday, all the good hiding spots get taken in 3 seconds and there's basically nowhere to go. This is what we're asking our children to think about in the classroom. There is no question that it's important for all people to feel a sense of belonging, belonging to something. And mental health has suffered for a lot of people in the past 2 years. But the United States does not have a monopoly on mental health challenges. Patrick Blanchfield is the author of the forthcoming Gun Power, The Structure of American Violence. He's an associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research and a freelance journalist. Patrick, welcome back to Connections. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk, albeit granted the circumstances.
Yeah.
Pleasure is more of a formalism than
I
make you feel like. Yeah.
Certainly. And you know, I want to probe something that you've talked about in various places. And let me see if I can summarize it correctly, but I want to give you some space here. There is a strain of American exceptionalism that says these kinds of weapons are appropriate tools to allow Americans to exert control and agenda abroad or on a battlefield. And the downstream effect is that some number of Americans are going to use these weapons to exert their own dominance or agenda in public spaces, to air out any number of grievances. And very often you write that it is white men, as we saw in Buffalo, continuing a history that kind of has roots with slavery and native dispossession. Can you elaborate on some of those themes?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think focusing on this idea of exceptionalism is really helpful because it unfolds in a bunch of ways, right? Like the history of the U.S. is remarkably exceptional, right? To the extent to which we are at present the primary like global hegemon, you know, and we are also exceptional in that we are the largest per capita and in raw owner of firearms on the planet. Mm-hmm. We're also the largest manufacturer, exporter, and importer of small arms as well. And, you know, we're exceptional in some other ways too. For example, like per capita, we have more people in prison than any other nation on the planet, right? And I think those are properly staggering things. And in some ways, I think we're also exceptional though in how whenever tragedies like this occur, we enter this cycle of not really thinking about them in relation to those exceptional facts, right? Whether they be historical stuff that falls out by the wayside or just the raw numbers of how many guns we have and how central they are to American history and to symbolically and materially American power projection globally. And what I try to do in my work and what I'm very happy to talk with you about is the way in which firearms have been really essential to both like the material execution of the American project, if we want to call it that, but also to like the self-understanding of what it means to be American in terms of a kind of unspoken and broader ideology. And there is a way in which, you know, guns are tools that empower people. And then there's this other way in which we're inclined to only ever think about ourselves, generally speaking, as being the people who are wielding them as the good guys and not about being on the receiving end of them. And it takes events like these to sort of briefly, for increasingly short moments of time, make us rethink our position in that equation and then to reflect on, hopefully, which is what I'd like us to do, the features of that exceptionalism that we kind of allied or forget in other moments.
Well, 3 years ago, you talked to NPR about shooter manifestos. And that conversation, I mean, word for word, could apply to the Buffalo mass shooting. It's a sick kind of version of rinse repeat in this country. And I'd like to ask you to talk a bit about what you think we should, maybe a little bit of what we can learn from these manifestos, but also maybe why you view them as basic and even predictable screeds.
Yeah. So I talked to, I think, the NPR national desk right after the shooting in El Paso in 2019, where, if I recall correctly, a man armed with some sort of semi-automatic rifle, I forget the specific make and model, went into a local Walmart and explicitly expressed the intention in this manifesto of killing people who he thought would be Latinx. I think he may have also shot and killed a civilian concealed carrier who drew on him or some other specifics like that, right? But in any event, the fellow in question, whose name I'm not going to say and who I've also kind of repressed, and I'll say why the names actually aren't that important in a moment, did write this long manifesto, right? And he's hardly the first mass killer to write a manifesto. And I read these for, you know, as a professional obligation, whenever they're written, whether they be one mass shootings that are more nationally prominent or ones that are smaller and local or ones that don't quite pan out, right? And so I've been reading these now for about 10, 12 years, and also ones that are sort of international in scope, because part of what is particularly distressing about the events in Buffalo and then the event in El Paso is that there is a sort of an emergent genre of right-wing racist mass killer manifesto. And I will say that it's worth for a second reflecting on like what the etymology is of like a manifesto, right? I mean, it makes something manifest. It's a statement, right? It's supposed to be a political articulation. It's supposed to explain someone's actions and presumably inspire other people to follow in the person, the author's footsteps, right? But like with these manifestos, which do form a genre, right? They cite one another. They're all kind of written at this. It's weird to evaluate this aesthetically, right? And I'm not trying to do that primarily, but like they're all written at a certain level of like, if you've read a couple long Facebook posts,
yeah, right,
or like a college level, like a freshman level essay. And it's like, you know, it's not the Communist Manifesto, right? Or like it's not like some manifesto by 1960s artist, right? That, even no matter what you feel about those things, like those at least have some stylistic merits. But these are these kind of generic statements about like why a person chooses to do this and who inspired them and what weapons they chose and why this target and what are the global political cultural circumstances that have driven this action as opposed to say something else. And oftentimes they account for that. And the thing is like they refer to one another. And so there's very little that's surprising in them. They refer to the same cultural like texts of some, or they make reference to or resemble certain novels and occasionally films and the like that are, have been in, you know, the fringes, if not quite the mainstream. But also, and this is why I want to call attention to the like that etymology, a lot of times it just sounds like someone saying the quiet part out loud, or like making manifest what is said elsewhere by quote unquote respectable people with very substantial platforms.
We're talking political leaders, mainstream political leaders, et cetera.
Mainstream political leaders, a whole lot of pundits, not just of the right wing, but oftentimes of the moderate or even center left variety. A lot of people who have, you know, frame it as who are saying things like, well, we're really concerned about the future of American identity and the delusion, like the dilution of that, or we're extremely concerned about the lack of a cultural ethic, or the fact that we're no longer like teaching our kids to appreciate the glorious Western heritage, right? You know, and these are things that are said oftentimes about specific issues like immigration, et cetera, but also are sometimes just articulated as almost like tics or tropes, like, and we may have like people whom we know in our lives who will just name check or those thinkers, or who will just like be like, well, you know, I feel like kids these days are complaining and about things that are just weak, right? And a lot of these, when it comes from people with political platforms or people who pundits who have substantial platforms in their own right, like oftentimes they're subtle enough that they never really go the next step, right? A lot of the thinkers I'm thinking about who are, well, thinkers is also a generous term for them, but they at least write at something other than like a freshman in college level, will be like, well, we should ask, I'm just asking questions.
Yeah, I exactly love how that much phrase. Just asking questions.
Oh my God. Just asking questions. And it's like, well, how much immigration is too much immigration, right? When is it appropriate to question if the complexion of your neighborhood has changed too much? When does the United States become unrecognizable, right? And of course, it's always just asking questions. And what these manifestos do, I would argue, is sometimes they ask the questions in ways that are, again, very similar, if poorly spelled, but also they answer them, right? They're like, well, yeah, okay, now is the time we've determined this, and here's what I do about it. So they sort of manifest what's late. Implied, like they follow through on what's in the broader discourse already and what's normalized in the broader discourse. And so in that way, like, yes, they're exceptional. These documents, to go back to this theme of exceptionalism, these documents are like the body counts of the events that accompany them are striking, but they throw into relief and when you consider that background of what's like normal in the discourse, or what's like reasonable people are supposedly allowed to think and say, and we encourage people, well, you're just asking questions, then they don't actually seem that exceptional at all.
Yeah. And to be clear, let me be as explicit as I can. You're talking about Tucker Carlson, but not just Tucker Carlson. And it seems to me, Patrick, that part of the point is when these viewpoints, which are essentially racist without using I think there's a real sort of sickness in the discourse that says, well, if you didn't use the N-word or if you didn't use a racist epithet, then it wasn't really racist. So you get away with a lot of racism in public platforms and on national platforms because of the narrowly defined what is racist. And so it's Tucker Carlson, yes, but it's not just Tucker Carlson. And it seems to me that part of the concern that you're raising is when it gains more velocity, it's not just fringy, it's not just outliers, it's not just evil monsters, that are going to be once in a while, that we can, with the proliferation of the number of firearms we have, we're going to see an acceleration of these sort of events. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. And like, look, I do think some people, like I mean, Tucker Carlson, I think is, who knows what's going on in his interiority, right? I have some suspicions of what he truly believes, but I think, you know, Occam's razor, if you cut that through his output, let's call it his oeuvre, I think he's, you know, probably a pretty rabid white supremacist. But even if you don't believe that, right? Even if you don't think that he clearly does, and I think, you know, there's been stuff in the Times about this, he and his producers do seem to enjoy, let's say, trolling the libs, right? Throwing certain things out there and it will always be very offended. How dare you say I'm racist, et cetera, even as I talk about immigrants as vermin or draw metaphors between them and, you know, pond scum or whatnot, or rats, et cetera. But like, the truth of the matter is like, hell, I can think specifically right before the spring of that, of 2019, before that massacre in a Walmart, there was a cover story in The Atlantic magazine written by former Bush speechwriter and current neocon intellectual, putting that term in scare quotes as well, David Frum. And the question, and the question that I think was on the front of the, with a picture of an American flag in neon, like it was a no vacancy sign at a motel, was how much immigration is too much? And then if you, the sub lead of that article, I believe, was something like, if liberals don't act on immigration, then fascists will. Right. And he was just diagnosing, raising the question that other people were too polite to ask, supposedly, namely, like, how much immigration is too much? When is the national character, he wouldn't say polluted, but when has it been altered excessively? Right. And again, like, it's not, he didn't use the words great replacement theory. He didn't use the phrase decline of the West, and he didn't drop any slurs. Right. But also, if you already have a disposition, or if you already are asking certain questions about the people in the world around you, and you can read that into this, right? Or rather, you are participating the way like a fish swims in water as the temperature of that water changes, the metaphors of your heart, right? These things become imaginable, right? These scripts, the people continually gesturing to a certain set of people as being quote unquote like the problem, right? Or making an entire class of people seem to be disposable, right? Or somehow that they don't belong, undermining their claims to existence, albeit through just like, you know, asking questions, like that does have ramifications. I'm not saying narrowly that this guy, the guy in El Paso, like read David Frum. I doubt he read much of anything besides forum posts and then went out and did this massacre. But I am saying that there were a lot of people just asking questions about whether or not really vulnerable people had a right to exist when you got right down to it. Mm-hmm. And putting that out there, you know, there's a kind of wish casting to that, or kind of, it makes stuff imaginable. And I think that's like another thing to think about too. Like, I think this country is exceptional in the way in which this scenario, the idea of, well, I'm going to take my gun and I'm going to go kick off a racial holy war, that's imaginable and out there, that's a script that's imaginable for people, is not necessarily something that exists in other countries. And that's as much part of the ambient surround.
Yeah, so it's exceptional in that way. One of the reasons, one of the things that makes this country exceptional, the word exceptional, the root is exception, and that makes them. It does. And there's no question, by the way, that the Buffalo mass shooting fits that paradigm. In Texas yesterday, I want to ask you, you know, I don't mean to be crass, but to think about this event in specific ways, is this different? I mean, what we know so far is that an 18-year-old apparently didn't have many friends, was kind of a loner at school, was picked on a lot, frequently screamed at his mother when he was playing Fortnite for hours on end. His chosen target was not, as in Buffalo, Black people, or as in El Paso, Latinos, it was children. So was this different in your mind?
So it's different in some ways, right? Like clearly it's different in the sense that he didn't live stream what he did on Twitch, and he didn't write a 10,000, to the best of our knowledge yet, we haven't found a 10,000 word like screed slash program of justification slash meme compendium outlining what he did, right? In terms of a legible political program. Right. And I think that's a distinction that's worth making. It's also, I think, a distinction worth making that, you know, that there can be differences between the individual backgrounds of people who act out sort of scripts for social violence and the historical reason why those scripts or those are available in the first place. Right. I'm not 100% sure on what the ethnicity of the shooter was, right, in Texas, but I don't believe he was white, and in the particular same way in which like the Sonnen Rod wearing Nazi sort of sympathizing fellow in Buffalo was, right? But it is worth saying here that it was imaginable for this young man in a way that I think is distinctively American for him to buy a pair of assault rifles for his 80th birthday or thereabouts, and then take them to his school and shoot them up as a way of vindicating his personal grievances, whatever they were, who knows, right? And I will say too that there are some similarities between that shooting and some other ones. Most notably, I would think, and we just passed the anniversary of it, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, right? Which was another deeply troubled young man, Adam Lanza, who had kind of prolific existence in various online communities or like posting, but he was studious about deleting his hard drives, etc. But who also appears, well, definitely as a matter of fact, shot a woman close to him. Right, Adam Lanza shot his mother several times in the head while she slept before going to an elementary school and shooting that up. This young man appears to have shot his grandmother. Right, I think who may still be alive as of the time.
Yep, that's what I'm reading. Yep.
And then went to the school to do this. And so, like, it's particularly in cases like these, and by the way, I should say, with like the Adam Lanza one, as with this one, there were abundant red flags in terms of school people, like school administrators, psychologists, et cetera, like being concerned about what was happening in this young man's home or what his intentions were, et cetera. I mean, in fact, later, this is the thing that I tell people and they think I'm often making it up, but it's entirely true. There was a whistleblower from someone, a friend of, I believe, Adam Lanza's mother, who I told authorities that Adam had access to an assault rifle and was going to shoot up Sandy Hook Elementary School several years before he did it. And the authorities' response, it's largely been redacted, appears to have been to basically tell this woman that, or tell the person who blew the whistle on that or who informed that the guns belonged to Nancy and that there was nothing they could do about it and she should stop bothering the family, I think is basically how that panned out. But like, what I'm getting at here is, in both these cases where we have young men who clearly are, there's something black box happening inside them. Right? Who knows what their interior states were? Who knows what they thought they believed, what their psychological problems may or may not have been, right? We're just because they're dead, right? You know, Adam killed himself. This young man may have been shot by police or whatever, or ended his own life. I'm not sure if we've even determined that yet. But in both cases, it was imaginable for them to do this. It was materially possible for them to do this, right? And they may be outliers in the sense that they were disturbed. And they may be outliers too, in the sense that they didn't have an explicit political ideology in the way that the fellow in Buffalo did or the way that the fellow in El Paso did, right? But they could still take advantage of the political material circumstances and the social imagination that made it possible for them to do what they did.
Yeah. And reporting this morning from the Washington Post finds that the shooter in Texas yesterday had run-ins with police over the following: cutting his own and disfiguring his own face, shooting people at night with a BB gun, and neighbors called police over fights with his mom when he was playing Fortnite, just screaming matches and shouting that got, you know, threats of violence. So police had this guy, so to speak, on the radar. And yet it's also been reported that when he turned 18, the day he turned 18, went straight out and bought two of these rifles without any trouble. And so here's where, Patrick, I want to talk a little bit about policy with you, because we're talking about culture. Last night, a piece of video went viral featuring Steve Kerr, a man who lost his own father to gun violence. He's now the head coach of the Golden State Warriors in the NBA. And the part that went viral was his anger, calling out Mitch McConnell, saying that the Republicans in Washington were in the back pocket of gun manufacturers. But I want to ask you about something else that Kerr said. He said that something like 90% of Americans want extensive background checks. And this is something that Nicholas Kristof has written about, saying that there are points of basic agreement across party lines. Do you agree with that, that there are viable policy levers that could be pulled that would make a difference here?
I think it's important to disambiguate a bunch of things, if you don't mind.
Yeah,
please
do.
Question. Right, like, the first thing I'd say is that I think it's from a 10,000 feet up perspective, one question might be to ask, like, why does this system as it currently exist, right? Whose rights does it protect or was it designed to protect, and what does it make possible, right? I think that's an important thing to just sort of stipulate up front, right? Like,
And I think you could argue, for example, with a lot of this violence, say like particularly the through line of domestic violence, right, or violence against women, both in the case of this most recent shooter, right, and in people like Adam Lanza and who knows, in a great many of these shooters, in fact, the overwhelming majority of these young men, there is a history of domestic violence, red flags are raised, the authorities are alerted, et cetera. But even with that being the case, there are no substantive interventions by law enforcement to deal with them, right? And so the question you might ask then is, well, what does a system that both enables this to some, or rather, it's like, who's being protected by the system overall? And the answer, I think, and you could think about other, you know, other things in the news, for example, the dismantling of Roe, is that this is a system that's about, historically speaking and practically speaking, descriptively speaking, is about protecting the rights of men above others. Right, and that is willing to absorb, say, domestic violence and let people get away with that, men get away with that, even at the price that that has downstream, right? So that's the kind of perspective I'd like us to have here, where it's like thinking about these things not as like failures of a system, but as sort of prices that the system in all its inertia is willing to pay.
In other words, it's not that the system is not working.
No, this is how the system was designed to work. That's what I would like people to think about. It's like even as a thought exercise to think about this. And there have been cases, you know, in the past, recently, a couple of years ago, I can think of two or three of them, right, where women have attempted to have restraining orders enforced against partners, right, who are violent, right, and who have guns, but haven't crossed certain lines, and you know the restraining orders aren't followed through. Or in a couple of cases, I can think of one. I think in Florida, maybe 2-3 years ago, a woman. I don't want to get the details of this wrong, but I do know this has happened at least once and made national news, and it's happened more times than that, I'm certain. Where a woman who is terrified of her partner, quite rightly so, will take his guns and bring them to the police station, and then face charges for stealing his guns. Right. And I would also say, too, that we can turn to the data about, for example, police, right, who are statistically very likely to be domestic abusers, et cetera, and they don't enforce these, you know, these restraining orders, et cetera, on one another, and not the least because if they were to lose access to their guns, then they couldn't do their jobs, and they're afraid of one another, too. But, like, so in all these circumstances, right, I think you could look at how these laws are actually enforced and the gaps between who these laws are said to protect and who they actually protect to get a sense of how the system is designed to function, right? Even at the point at which there is a concrete warning that Adam Lanza is going to shoot up a particular school, it doesn't matter because those guns belong to his mother, who is a fairly wealthy woman. And it kills her in the end, the system does, right? So that's a key point I want to make. Like there are red flags for everybody. The red flags are raised in schools around the country, right? For young men in particular, all the time. However, in terms of when it comes to like who gets sent to juvenile detention, who gets medicated, you know, like there are clear disparities in who's targeted by that, right? Young men who are black and brown and poor are not going to. Well, never mind that they're not going to have someone like Nancy Lanza buying them guns for their birthday. But they're also, you know, if they draw the same things he did, they're not going to, let's just say that there's a school to prison pipeline for some and not others. And if to pull back, like that system is designed to protect the interests of certain people. Right.
Sure.
And
And I bring up, I bring up policy and frankly, I bring up Steve Kerr just because he is a public figure. His comments go viral. Yeah. They sort of predictably get parodied by Ben Shapiro and others, but you know, Kerr lost a father to gun violence. He's not saying that background checks are going to solve everything, I think part of his point is even where there is agreement across ideologies, which seems increasingly rare, we still don't get policy that reflects it. And I don't know if it is if you just view that as sort of fruitless to focus on policy at this point.
Well, I think it's worth saying, just yeah, because I don't want to ignore his plangent and trenchant observations, nor your question, right? So I will say, like, let's say this explicitly: to the extent to which like we are existing now in a position of like minoritarian governance, right, yeah. Where the party that's nominally in power and controls the legislature, both houses of the legislature and the presidency, seems to be unable to do anything except tell people to vote. Right. At the point in which like the the courts, right, are populated by people who are, you know, for, you know, a majority of them are say, like, right-wing Federalist Society sort of, like, anointees who have, you know, lied in their testimony and then will, before, about what they will or won't do, and are dead set upon doing things like rolling back the right to an abortion, which also is the thing that most Americans support, statistically speaking. Like, yeah, I think you can say that we're a nominal democracy, but our democratic institutions are not functioning in any coherent way. There's no accountability in this. I think that's just, several things are broken here, right? Whether it be the apparatus of voting, right? Which is, of course, also being dismantled too, you know, and God knows how the next elections are going to go around. But also, like, I think we could say that just, like, even on those things in which there is near universal sense that something should be done, right? And even if some of those policies might be misguided, like, but let's just say, like, a majority of Americans, let's just stipulate, if a majority of Americans wanted an assault weapons ban, they couldn't have that, right? If a majority of Americans wanted, I don't know, more stringent licensing for concealed carry, right? Let's just stipulate. I don't know empirically if they do, but let's say they did. That's not going to change the fact that the court is probably going to move forward with, like, universal reciprocal concealed carry, like, provisions. It's a very possible world in which that's going to happen. And meanwhile, the legislature will, you know, get caught. The Democrats in the legislature will complain about, well, we can't do anything about the filibuster and we can't pack the courts, etc. So, like, I think there is a point at which, like, asymmetric polarization combined with, like, institutional inertia means that majoritarian desires for efficacious policy interventions on guns or anything else are, there's something desperate about that.
Talking to Patrick Blanchfield, who is the author of the forthcoming Gun Power, The Structure of American Violence. He's an associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, a freelance journalist who've been writing about guns and culture for years now. And it seems like every time we've got Patrick on this program, it is a sad and similar conversation. But we are talking about the events of this month, the mass shooting in Buffalo, the murder of children in Texas yesterday. And when we come back from our only break of the hour, I'm going to share a little bit more about what some policymakers are saying today, and then we'll take some of your feedback as well for Patrick. Stay right here. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation from 2017 with Jeremy Richmond, the father of 6-year-old Aviel Richmond, one of the students murdered at Sandy Hook in 2012. The interview with Jeremy was painful, one of the hardest hours we've ever done on this program, but we are bringing it back because we think everyone needs to hear it. That is next hour here on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Senator Ted Cruz said last night that new gun laws don't work, that you can't take away rights for law-abiding citizens, and that anyway, people who want to commit harm are going to commit harm. Senator Rick Scott of Florida said this morning to journalists in regards to proposals to ban AR-15s, quote, "I think we have in our Constitution our Second Amendment rights, and we shouldn't take away rights for law-abiding citizens," end quote. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida argued that expanded background checks would not solve the problem and said even if Washington banned AR-15s, a killer would find a different weapon. Here's what he told reporters, quote, "At the end of the day, you're arguing about what they're using to commit this. And the truth of the matter is these people are going to commit these horrifying crimes. Whether they have to use another weapon to do it, they're going to figure out a way to do it," end quote. Now, by the way, Marco Rubio is among the Republicans who've called for locking down schools more, for making sure schools have more armed guards, turn schools into fortresses. And Senator Rubio is ignoring the inconsistency in his own logic here. If his idea is that if somebody wants to murder children in a school, they're going to do it one way or another, then if schools are locked down, does he propose not letting kids out in open air? No outdoor concerts anymore? No Little League games anymore? Or should we also have walled fortresses around our Little Leagues? What is he proposing to make sure? I'm not looking for a world where there's no risk, but I don't understand this idea that, well, you know, You can't take away AR-15s because, you know, if somebody wants to hurt you with a wrench, they'll hurt you with a wrench. I mean, come on, man. Some things can do more damage than others here. Yeah. And I don't, this is something that somebody listening, you know, I brought this up after Buffalo, and maybe I'll ask Patrick to weigh in. But what I said on this program after Buffalo is, we have conservative listeners and progressive listeners and people in all parts of the spectrum, and conservative listeners who are very guarded of their gun rights, first of all, are very generous with emailing with me, and I appreciate the give and take, and we try to be good faith, and I hope that will continue. And one of the things I said that day was, you don't need those things to hunt. If you do, you're a bad hunter. Mm-hmm. And you don't need those things to have fun. I think that you're more than capable of finding other outlets to enjoy yourself, especially if those things can be used to kill quickly in a large amount. Now, somebody emailed and said, Evan, in a world where government oppression is more and more likely, citizens have to defend themselves. And I said, sickly and sadly, that's the best argument I've heard so far for keeping AR-15s. But can somebody else give me something more? Patrick, what am I missing here? And when you hear what Senator Rubio is saying, what Senator Scott is saying, what comes to mind here?
Right. I'm going to try not to get you like a violation here by like, I'm restraining my desire to be profane. Right. But like, I mean, like, I think,
thank you for self-editing.
Yeah. I'm censoring here. I don't want to get us canceled, but I think the logic of that, of those statements, which is basically all the same, right, could like, namely, like, well, if we can't have laws because people will violate the laws, is ludicrous on the face of it. It doesn't apply across any other example, right? These are positions that are diametrically opposed to things that those same people will say otherwise, right? Like, you don't have conservative figures saying, well, no, we actually can't roll back Roe v. Wade because women are going to have abortions anyways. Right. Which of course they will. Right. They don't. The truth of the matter is, though, is just like look at like systematically, what are their actual priorities being revealed by this? Right. And that is like, you know, in the case of abortion, that they don't care if women die. And this like, well, you know, the price that they're willing to pay is, you know, billions of dollars more for a private security industry, which already exists. And, you know, yeah, people get to have ARs, even if that does mean that certain kids get killed regularly. Right. And I think that's, on some level, like that's like what you can do to the quote-unquote logic is to look at this as basically like, well, this is actually a statement sort of about positive commitment to certain quote-unquote values, but also it ratifies the status quo and outcomes, right? So it's not like, no, we can't have laws because because laws will just create, like prohibition will create desire. No, they don't care about these. Like for all the protestations on some level, they're willing to deal with or not deal with, rather, the carnage. But the other thing I'd say is that these aren't even logical propositions in many cases, right? They're sort of like the way like a squid when it's cornered just shoots out a whole bunch of ink so it can get away, right? This is just verbiage to temporize, to muddy the waters, to hit a whole series of notes and values, and then just hope that the conversation moves on, which it does.
Well, but here's the part that I think, and this is the last thing I'll ask you about, and then I'll let our listeners jump in here, but I want to speak a little more pragmatically here. And, you know, I've heard listeners argue that, hey, for now, the senators are right. Like, let's turn the schools into fortresses. More armed guards, very, very difficult to get in, et cetera, et cetera. And there has never been a country that had anywhere close to the volume of firearms that Americans have, to my knowledge, per capita, maybe a country or two that are small or close. But here's the point. By some counts, there are more guns than people in this country.
Yes.
Hundreds of millions of guns, and more are being produced and sold every day. And that strikes me as such a pervasive number that, you know, I frankly wonder, has it eclipsed any kind of effective gun policy? And is there a point to be made about locking down schools and the like simply because the toothpaste is out of the bottle here?
I mean, I think like here's another way in which Americans are exceptional, right? And I do think this actually does answer your question, but albeit not necessarily in a one-to-one way, right? Americans, unlike I think a lot of other people, have a way of thinking that not only that guns are the solution to problems, And even when the problem is guns, then we need yet more guns. And that may mean for some people on who self-identify as conservative, well, that means I concealed carry or we get teachers to carry. For other people, it may be like, we just need more cops with guns to take away the guns from the bad guys, right? Or to have like, I don't know, I've occasionally come across proposals that we need to hire veterans with sniper rifles to guard every single school, right? And again, like, these are emotive, like, they're basically just a statement of faith or a statement of values or just an expressive type of venting, but they always have this way of being articulated in complete opposition or apparent ignorance to the actual circumstances of the fact that, you know, well, there are tons of schools in this country that are already locked down. There are tons of schools in this country that are already full of cops.
There was a cop there yesterday. A cop engaged this guy yesterday. Yeah,
exactly. And what do? Right? They don't stop these people. They oftentimes they enact violence against the children that they're supposed to protect. Their workplaces for these people like anything other. And so there have been circumstances where SROs have shot themselves or colleagues. Right? It's just a doubling down on the circumstances that make this all possible. Right? So I think the flip side of the fact that like this type of violence, this type of exceptional violence, is made imaginable for a small minority of bad actors, whether they be politically motivated or just disturbed in some very, very malevolent ways that are also, you know, politically salient. The flip side of that is a complete inability to imagine solutions to problems that aren't just about guns, right? Just throwing more guns at the problem or having more police come in to take away guns from other people. I mean, so I think in some ways that's a self-fulfilling kind of dialectic, and that's what's at stake in a lot of the gun control versus gun rights debates. Like, I do think there are policies that we can make to ameliorate this stuff, but I think ultimately, like, we're already doubling down on security. We're already doubling down on more police. We're already doubling down on arming people to supposedly protect people, and it hasn't worked, right? If any of that had worked, if punishment and arming the authorities had worked for anything, then, well, among other things, that we wouldn't have, the war on drugs would have continued for decades, but also we wouldn't be having this problem now, right? These are like gasps or articulations of a terminal, like a terminally blinkered worldview, and it's pathetic and tragic.
Well, let me get some feedback from listeners. Thomas and Gates. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I would be in favor of a national law. It would be hard to enforce, I know, but a national law banning the types of weapons that were used in, well, both of these recent shootings and assault weapons or assault rifles. And, okay, now it would probably go to the Supreme Court, and the people who are against that would throw the Second Amendment in our faces. How would you get around the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms and all that? What would be the response to that,
Patrick?
I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I mean, like, I think the court at this point has ratified. I mean, this is a Scalia legacy, right? There is an individual right to bear arms. He opens the door a little bit to say that certain military weapons don't have a place in civilian hands, but he clearly and explicitly in various other places says that doesn't include AR-15s, right? So I think the answer here is to think about, I mean, like, is to think about two things. One, right, what happened the last time we had an assault weapons ban? Right. And I think if we look at that historically, what happened under the same guy who happens to be president now, who helped engineer that legislation in the Senate at the time, what we basically got was a banning of a certain set of weapons, plus a massive mandate for police to stop and frisk young people and to arm SWAT teams. And none of that really helped with the vaster majority of gun violence in this country, right, which is carried out with handguns and not assault weapons. And then that ban expired. So, like, I think something to think about here, if we are wedded to courts and to proceduralist legal challenges to the presence of assault weapons or gun violence in general, I mean, why not open up, like, there is a mechanism for having a constitutional convention, right? There is a mechanism for altering the Constitution. And I understand right now that even the people in power say that, you know, like the filibuster blocks thing and the asking them to actually govern is too much to ask. But if that's the case, well, why not go big and ask them to alter the Constitution. It's been done before. At least that opens the horizon of what's imaginable. Right? Well, the other thing I it's like I think like a lot of the red flag stuff is key insofar as that, like, I think kids these days, and I hate to use that phrase, but like, you're not, people who pick up a gun and go to murder other people, particularly children, are not coming from a place of happiness and joy and social connection, right? And so if maybe something we can do is just make life less miserable and make that less socially imaginable. I know that sounds vague, but there's a circularity to what's on the table for us that exhausts and frustrates and I think depoliticizes.
Well, Mary Lee in Rochester spent the morning doing what, Mary Lee?
Hi, thanks for taking the call, yep. And thanks for this show. I spent the morning calling. I wanted to know, what can I do today, right now, because I'm so angry and so I feel hopeless and helpless, and I wanted something to do today. So I looked up all of the senators. There are over 50 that take money from the NRA, and sometimes to the tune of well over $4 million, and in their very state, maybe 1,400, excuse me, people die from a gun death every year. And I don't know how those people sleep at night, but I called them to ask them to vote yes on the background check bill. I mean, that's something, it's a small step, but it's concrete. You can find this information on, there's a Brady.gov, it's the Brady Bill website. All that information is there. You can find the number to the Senate. It's easy to do. You can call senators from other states in case people don't know. That's very easy to do.
Mary Lee, thank you. And I know you're trying to do your part at a time of anger and intense emotion. Patrick, I'm not sort of trying to provoke any cynicism. I'm wondering if you feel like that is a fruitful set of efforts there.
I mean, I'm not going to armchair psychoanalyze someone like Mitch McConnell. I mean, though one is tempted to say the man is probably a stone cold sociopath, but again, I'm not going to do that. Like, I think there are, I need to be careful about what I say here, right? Because like, note, we've already been told by immediately, like we got more action from the powers that be telling people not to be angry with signs on public property outside the houses of Supreme Court justices than we got in response to this, right? You know, 19, 20 children are dead. And the response from Chuck Schumer is go vote in November. Right. They acted more quickly. The Democratic leadership acted more quickly vis-a-vis like people potentially offending Brett Kavanaugh or, you know, God forbid someone, and here I'm thinking of Nancy Pelosi being particularly egregious about this, God forbid someone come for their right or the right of their staffs to basically do insider trading while sitting in Congress, right? So I think that on some level, while I laud people trying to bring some degree of voter accountability to these figures, I also think you can't shame the shameless. And I think that part of what is striking about their responses recently to direct action protests by private individuals is that does seem to shake them, right? They don't seem to like it when people are in their face demanding that they do something or simply expressing rage and grief. And to whatever extent the channels are about exhausting that, I say, you know, overflow those channels. Try something. Try that, you know?
All right, let's keep it tight. Rick and Brighton next on the phone. Hi, Rick, go ahead.
Hello, Evan. My comment is simply this. Haven't we really lost the war against guns? There are more than 300 million guns circulating in the United States. They're everywhere. They're being used to kill people in Rochester on a weekly basis. The tragedy in Texas, like Buffalo, is awful in the extreme. But are we going to confiscate all these weapons? Are we going to stop the manufacturers who are producing hundreds of these weapons every day and selling them? I just get the sense that even if we were to establish some form of gun control now, the horse has already left the barn. I'll take the answer from your participants off the air.
Rick, thank you. And I'll just say, Rick's call, Patrick, reflects my question on pragmatism earlier. A lot of the proposals I hear are the kinds of proposals you make if you are starting a society from scratch and you haven't manufactured hundreds of millions of guns that are already out there. And I think that's kind of what Rick is saying. What do you think, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, like, look, let's be real. The fact that America has lost the war on something, whether it be drugs or in a particular theater abroad or on guns, has never been a reason why America hasn't doubled down, despite that, on continuing to wage it. Right. So like, I mean, I hear what he's saying. I share the sentiment, but I do want to be clear about what that metaphor buys us, which is nothing. But I will say that, like, yes, like, I think at this point, the most fruitful possible policy interventions generally involve doing stuff that doesn't fit the frame of the gun control debate. But also, on another level, I do think, and this is something that the caller just mentioned, and which was a politically discussed opportunity decades ago before it was basically destroyed in the 1920s and 30s, but I do think people should talk more about the ways in which U.S. legislators are beholden not to the NRA per se narrowly, but to arms manufacturers more generally, and not just small arms, but people who make planes and artillery and tanks. Like, the military-industrial complex in this country is enormous and real, and it shapes policy. And I think that should be on the table.
Patrick Blanfield's forthcoming book is called Gun Power: The Structure of American Violence. He's an associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, a freelance journalist. And I do wish we could talk about other things, Patrick, but I am grateful for the perspective and the time that you give our listenership here. Thank you for being here.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Patrick Blanfield. And listeners, next hour, please stay here, and as hard as it is, hang in there and listen to the conversation we're going to bring you with Jeremy Richmond, who lost his daughter at the age of 6 at Sandy Hook. That's coming up.